Hey, welcome to the new CNADHD podcast. I'm your host, Liz Lewis, and I don't want to produce another boring podcast. I want to talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly of living the ADHD life. And yeah, I definitely want to have a cocktail while I do it. My goal is to bring together the best experts and the best information about ADHD and to make it understandable and actionable.
Okay. I have today David Darwin with me. What do you call yourself?
One man sideshow.
One man sideshow. Do you know I keep telling people you're the international man of mystery and I don't know where I got it though. Like I keep saying that to people. I'm interviewing the international man of mystery.
One man sideshow was not a great choice of tagline. It's way too long. It's amazing. Very often people like, well, like right on the brochure, on the poster, like David Darwin, one man show. And I'm like, that's not the part I want to like emphasize. Like okay. The fact that there's just one of me is not actually the part that's important.
And okay. Well, like, what should the name be then?
You know, so I know another guy who went with like one man variety show and I'm like, well, that's a little better. Most people don't know what sideshow is. So then at least he doesn't have, you know, I think that's variety show is a little more self, you know, explanatory. And then there's a different friend of mine who went with Solo Circus. I was like, ah, oh, nailed it. Yes.
Yeah. Actually, I didn't even think of it as a circus thing. I literally think of you as a stage performer.
Thank you. That is, you know, a lot of the stuff that I do has its origins either in the circus or in the sideshow, which was, you know, part of the circus, for many years, those two things sort of divorced at a certain point.
But, okay. What I always do at the beginning of every show is I ask people to tell me their ADHD story.
Yeah, mine is complicated. So when I was a kid, school was problematic early on, and kindergarten and first grade. And then starting in second grade, I went to a private school for kids with learning disabilities. I grew up in New Jersey. I don't know if it's even, I should actually look this up if it's still in business as a center school. And that was on the whole, a good experience, and helpful. Most of the kids there had, you know, either ADHD or ADHD and a lot of, you know, other sort of comorbid conditions. That was, a good experience. And yet, you know, in that there was sort of a range of different, you know, diagnoses there. Like whenever then and now, whenever I would sort of ask my parents about like, what's my diagnosis? Their answer was like, it's just some bullshit, whatever. Like to ask them now, like what was the official diagnosis I was given? They were like, oh, I don't know. Some nonsense. Yeah. So I think they saw it as like, oh, I mean, like, I'm not sure how much of this is like for my benefit or how much of this is for their benefit, you know, but like the way they always frame it is that like we ran this scam. We got you into this school where they had like 10 kids in a classroom and two teachers in each, you know, in each room.
Yeah.
And like that's kind of the way they, you know, sort of think about it, or at least claim to. And so like I was not like officially diagnosed until adulthood, until fairly recently. Or rather, I'm sure I had an official diagnosis then that, you know, is still unknown to me. I've given some thought to trying to like look it up. In any event, I came back to public school when I was in seventh grade, which was a terrible time to come back to public school.
Yes, middle school.
Yeah, middle school. It was awful. You know, managed to sort of be fully, you know, and I had, you know, sort of a, what is it, IED for, I guess, 2 years or so, I think.
Okay. An IEP. You had an
IEP. Thank you. Not okay. IED. That's an improvised explosive device. Yeah, that's slightly different. But yeah, so for most of high school had, you know, sort of as normal as it got, you know, sort of public high school experience. And went to Penn State for college. Majored in journalism. Kind of felt like that was the idea of being like, of working for a newspaper was a lot more attractive to me than sort of a standard cubicle job. I felt like, okay, I'll be in my cubicle writing some of the time. And then like, I have to like go out and report. Like I have to go out into the world.
Mm-hmm.
and that's part of the job. And that sounded way better to me.
Yeah.
Than spending all of my time in a cubicle.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
What was it like academically at Penn State with ADHD? Like, did you have any accommodations or?
No, I had no official accommodations. My pattern has always been that, the classes that held my interest, you know, were things that I really poured a lot of effort into. And so sort of tangentially, you know, sort of accidentally wound up with good grades in those things where I was, you know, most focused. And so in some ways I did better in a college environment where you have more sort of choice, and more agency over where you're spending your time and what, and, you know, have the option of, you know, dropping out of a class, either in terms of the material or in terms of just the professor.
Yeah.
You know, there were certainly subjects in high school where like 1 year I'd do really well and then I'd have a different teacher the next year. And I'm like, nope, I have no interest in this.
Yep.
This person doesn't know how to speak to me.
Yeah. And I think that's a familiar sort of story.
Sure.
I know I talked to a lot of people who actually, I don't know if anyone's ever said this to you, but I've had people tell me and other women I work with that, well, there's no way you could have ADHD because you went to college.
And while I recognize that there's a range, you know, in both in terms of different types of ADHD and different sort of severity, that is massively frustrating. And I give some thought now, you know, doing sort of circus style shows for a long time. I've given some thought to in recent years to doing a show about ADHD, you know, sort of using different acts as metaphor. And the metaphor I always think of here is that when I perform my sword swallowing act, there's a certain percentage of the audience that just will not believe me that I'm legitimately swallowing the sword. There's nothing I can do to convince them. And that used to upset me. There was so much work that went into learning it. I really wanted them to believe me that this was not a magic trick. While acknowledging, you know, yes, this could be a magic trick. I could fake this for you. You know, I have a lot of friends who are great magicians and they could fake this for you beautifully. You could be right next to me. You would never know the difference.
Wait, you can fake a sword swallowing thing?
Sure.
Do you know that I can't watch because it freaks me out? Like I can't watch, but I didn't
My
know.
My mother
can't
watch it. Either. No, you can very convincingly fake a sword.
Okay.
Sword.
All right. That's a whole other side story, but okay.
Sure.
but you're right. But, to convince people of something that isn't tangible.
Right. And I always felt like, yeah, it's a beautiful metaphor that my internal struggle there is completely invisible to them and is not believed by a certain portion of the audience.
That is a great metaphor, actually, yeah. I think.
Thank you.
I think that's a great metaphor. I think a lot of people with ADHD would identify with that. Yes.
Right. I'm not sure how well it would go over to the general public, but for me, that's, you know,
it is a whole internal struggle.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting that we have so much medical evidence now, but people still doubt it or still just say it's all in your head or, you know. You can pay attention.
That is precisely where it is located. Yes.
Yeah, that is precisely where.
That is where it happens. Yes.
Yeah, that's where my brain is. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And you know, it's funny to me that like there are a lot of there are a whole bunch of different bodies, you know, and like and I acknowledge that there are a lot of people who look perfectly able-bodied who have you know again sort of invisible physical you know conditions that you know. That impede their lives. But I think we're, I guess, sort of more used to the idea that like bodies are born in all kinds of different ways, you know? But like, I don't know why it's hard for some people, you know, I guess, you know, our experience of life is so subjective, you know, it's so easy for people to think that the way that I experience the world is exactly the way everybody else experiences the world.
Yes.
Like, and there are times when that's hard for me to remember too. Particularly with my kids, you know, it's really hard for me to like, remember that like, okay, that's not a grown, you know, that brain is at an entirely different stage of development, Dave. Like,
yeah.
Like when they're really little, like I almost feel like it's not, you know, I shouldn't even really think of them as human. Like it's not like I shouldn't anthropomorphize them at all, because otherwise they just, they come off as jerks. Like,
well, that's true about children. Children are not fully formed humans.
Right. And so I can't judge them the way I would judge fully formed humans, because otherwise they would just be jerks all the time. And that's not their fault. That's how they're built. Like, and I'm way better at this with my second kid than I am with my first, because my first kid, like, I take a lot of stuff personally that she does that now, like the second kid does. And I'm like, oh, that's just what you do. Like, I remember when the first one did this. Yeah, this is the time for that now. Oh, okay. I get it. So I'm guilty of this too, love, you know, thinking that, you know, you person who's, you know, human think exactly the same way that I do. Nope. And with them, I've got a visual cue. Like I should look at their tiny bodies and think your tiny brain way different than mine.
Oh. Yeah.
And yet I find it really hard to keep that in mind in my day-to-day dealings with them.
Oh, well with kids. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I have an 8-year-old and I still have to remind myself.
Like, right. Day. So yeah. Like I'm guilty of this too. Like I recognize it's way easy to assume that your head works exactly the same. Mine does. No, it doesn't.
Yeah. And I've also found, and just going back to like the career trajectory here. Mm-hmm. So like, you graduated from Penn State. Did you find that, like, I don't know, your first, I don't know how many jobs you've had before you became self-employed.
This right out of college.
Really?
Yeah, I never had a real job.
Oh, that is fascinating. How did you?
I have very mixed feelings. I have very mixed feelings about this now, because at the time, around my senior, so it was about midway through my senior year of college when I really made the decision, like, okay, I'm not going to get a real job. I'm just going to, you know, try to make a living as, you know, as an entertainer. At the beginning of my senior year, for whatever reason, Penn State decided to hire Penn and Teller to come be the like entertainment for like the freshman orientation, like kickoff, you know, weekend, whatever they were calling it. And so I came up to school a day or two early, because, you know, freshmen usually get there a day or two early, so I could see this show. Penn State had both a great juggling club, which was entirely like at that point, people who were juggling for fun, who had no intention of being performers, and a really great magicians club, which at that time was all people who really wanted to be professional magicians. And not all of them are now. Some of them have day jobs and perform on the side. But for the most part, that core group that I hung out with, they're all full-time pros now. Oh, right. So anyway, Penn and Teller were incredibly generous with their time with our little club afterwards and hung out with us for a couple hours. And just went to a coffee shop and talked for a while. And one of the things they really strongly recommended was don't get a day job, because when you have steady money coming in, you will never let go of it. And yet, and so like I felt really, you know, both smart and brave taking that advice. And yet that advice is so unusual in my I'm finding in my field, so many of my contemporaries talk about the day they decided that they were going to quit their day job, you know, and how like they were doing this on the side for like 2-3 years, finally made the decision to go full time, and how, you know, that hugely important moment in their lives. And I sometimes think about, man, I was starving for those first 2-3 years. Like if I had even put in like 10 hours a week at Starbucks, you know, like, for the first 3 years, that might have added up to like $10,000 that I could have, like, you know, put into the career in some way. You know,
I'm sure you've heard of, and I think I heard you discuss this, the concept of hyperfocus with ADHD.
Sure, yeah.
Do you think that the hyperfocus played a role in this?
In that decision? Or
in that decision, in the way that you were able to sustain it for 2 years. You just said you were starving for 2 years.
It was very, I mean, it was definitely a sense of adventure that sustained me through that first 2 years. Like there was, I mean, like me and my magician friends were like living in like a 2-bedroom apartment, like in West Philly, for like the rent on that place was like $700 a month that we for a while were splitting four ways. Like,
yeah.
And I was just barely making that. Like, yeah. I was, I was doing birthday parties for like $50, you know.
Okay.
But I could do like 5 of them in a weekend, you know.
Yeah. Kids' birthday parties, especially. Yeah.
You know, and like, that was, you know, I could live on that for like 2 years. I could live on like $50 a party, five of them a weekend.
I just think that's fascinating because with ADHD, you'll find some of us can do something like that, that they really are passionate about. And there's a sense of adventure and we have a novelty seeking.
Right. Exactly.
But I also think some of us, like I have this tendency, if I do something and I get kicked down too many times, it's really hard for me not to give it up and like walk away. Yeah. So you obviously had some kind of intrinsic motivation to keep going.
Yeah. And I wonder, you know, so I wonder if I had a day job, would it have been too easy to not perform as often, to, you know, pull back and not try to get as many gigs? There were many times when, you know, picking up the phone or sending an email and trying to make something happen is in so many ways to this day, the hardest part of this life and this lifestyle. And so there were a lot of times when just poverty was the main motivating factor between like sending somebody an email and being like, hey, I do these kinds of shows. Mm-hmm. Would you be interested in that? And so, yeah, that, I mean, it might've been the right decision for me to just go cold turkey and be like, no, leaving the real world and just doing this full time.
I think that's incredible. Because I think a lot of us, especially
the decision to go from being a broke college student to being a starving artist was not that difficult to transition. In many ways, it was a step up.
Okay.
So that was the easiest time of life to do it.
Yeah. I would be curious, like, do you follow, I think his name's Peter Shankman. He does the Faster Than Normal podcast.
No.
He's pretty big. He's like a venture capitalist. But he is ADHD to the max, and he admits it.
Uh-huh.
But he doesn't treat ADHD. He doesn't really believe in like the medication and stuff, from what I can tell. He is a heavy exerciser, but he is like a go all in kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like you would relate to his podcast he has a book too.
I'd be interested in checking it out. You know, for me, the journey to like medication, has been recent and has been like very much due to my kids.
Okay. I was going to ask you if you were currently treating ADHD in any way.
You know, for a while I had, you know, a lifestyle that I think was very much built around me, you know, and my needs. And that was fine, you know, when I was single or even when I was married. We made it work, but now, you know, my life has got to be built around their needs. And those were really difficult to meet, unmedicated. So things are better now.
Do you feel like the whole ADHD and the whole, I'm going to say your entrepreneurial streak.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that, your relationships with your family and then when you met your now wife, mm-hmm. do you feel like that all was like a smooth road, or
do I feel like my relationships with my family were a smooth road?
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
No, I do not.
So what did your family think of you doing this? Just
my family, I would call cautiously supportive. Like I was really gratified recently when one of my contemporaries in a different podcast interview was talking about how he got started, and he was like, well, none of the agents that I wanted to, you know, work with would work with me. So I started my own agency with a loan from my grandmother. You know, she gave me $10,000, and I was like, oh, that makes me feel so much better. Like there is no way, there was nobody who would loan me $10,000 to right. start this career, you know? There was always, you know, there was always a place I could sleep. There was always a place I could, you know, I could crash for the night. There was always a place, you know, there was always a meal there for me. I was always welcome. They were not going to bankroll my juggling career. And, which is fine. Like that was, you know, that was the level of support that I needed. You know, it's not the level of support that I dreamed of, but it's the level of support that I needed.
How did you explain it to your now wife? Like your lifestyle and your dreams, and like, how did you frame that?
How did I explain this to my wife? So my wife, had a lot of friends who were actors. She had like, you know, sort of dabbled in acting when she was a kid, but retained a lot of friends from that world when she left that world. She was also in journalism. She was had done TV news all her career and had worked up to being like a TV producer for like the morning news in Philadelphia by the time I met her. And so, you know, she was, which is a kind of show business. TV news is putting on a show every day, you know, 5 days a week. That she was, you know, when she first met me, she was like, you know, if you ever watched the news and like the person on TV, you know, listens to something in their ear and then goes, we have breaking news coming in. She's like, I'm the guy talking into their ear. So she, you know, was not, you know, particularly fazed by, you know, somebody who was, you know, like her best friend from childhood was like, you know, sort of a struggling artist, you know, in New York, actor. So that was not something that surprised or fazed her. My particular niche of the entertainment industry was a little different, but unusual to her.
Well, okay. So you met your wife and then you said that you have kids. You said two?
I have two kids. I have a 6-year-old and a 2-year-old.
Okay. And then like, tell me about the parenting with ADHD. I have my own thoughts on this, but tell me.
Sure. So, you know, I think parenting for anyone kind of stress tests your life.
And your marriage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And your marriage and your career and every, you know, yeah, every aspect of what you're, you know, sort of doing, creating, living at, you know, as an adult, you know, gets kind of, tested. And, so all of the sort of coping mechanisms that, again, were fine for me when I was single or when I was, even when I was married, were just no longer significant, you know, sufficient to the task. So, so yeah, that was the part where, and also like my, I don't know, just like my parents' style of parenting, like is not conducive to like sort of modern parent, you know, like my wife, you know, when we got married was like, you know, that we're never going to spank our kids. And I was like, yeah, okay. I'm down for that. You know? And then we had kids and she's like, you're yelling at the kids like every day. That's not okay. And I was like, okay, we should have had that discussion too. It is too late to have that because like yelling at children at full volume and I am loud. That's what parenting is to me. Like that was my whole experience of parenting is screaming at children. Right. And so like the thought of like parenting without that was just mind boggling to me.
Yeah.
And,
but you also don't have, I mean, with ADHD, you don't have the same filter, the same pause.
Yeah. And that's the medicated, like I now appreciate like, oh, wow. There's perspective here.
Yes.
That I did not have at all. And there's also like, I don't know, the fear, like there's so much fear as a parent. Like it strikes the fear into my heart in a way that like nothing else does. Like my own life, like risking my own life is something I always did so casually. Mm-hmm. It's just no issue for me, yep. You know, for my own, you know, imminent death, but like the slightest, you know, threat or just hint of, or suggestion of danger to my children is just like, suddenly my heart's racing and I'm screaming and like, and people are staring at me and it's like,
yeah. Yeah. It's a whole thing. And I do think, I don't know if you felt like this, but after my son was born, I thought to myself, I was like, if I don't deal, I've been ignoring the ADHD thing through my entire 20s.
Yeah.
Because it's just me. Who cares? Mm-hmm. Like, it didn't matter. Got married, bought a house. And yeah, that was a little challenging, being a spouse and like, taking care of a home. But when that baby came, it was like, if I want to show up, like if I want to be the kind of mom I want to be, not the kind of mom I had,
right?
But the kind of mom I want to be,
yeah.
Then I'm going to have to treat the ADHD thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, it hits you one day when your children are kind of small. Like you're just like, okay, I can't keep doing this. Yeah.
Yeah. My, you know, it's been, the past couple of weeks, I mean, when I'm home, when I'm not traveling, I'm usually in charge of putting the 2-year-old to bed. And lately, like, she wants me to like curl up next to her until she sleeps. Right. And lately, like, she curls up next to me and she starts whispering, "Keep me safe." That's both like heartwarming and like chilling in a way. Like, it's like that's a heavy burden. Like,
yeah,
there are times when I come to realize, and the other thing, I don't know, you have one child?
I have one. Yes. Yeah. I know my limits.
So, right. So this is part of what's tough, is that there are days when I feel like, so often in my life, the greatest threat to my 2-year-old is my 6-year-old.
Oh, wow. Like,
unintentionally.
Right.
Right. Completely innocently. But like, I can't let the mother bear out there. Like, I can't.
Yeah.
Like, there's a rage that comes with physical threat to my child that I can't direct at the other child.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's totally inappropriate. And so the greater perspective also is that there are a lot of times when I recognize, okay, the greatest like long-term threat to my child here is me. Like, psychologically, I do not want to damage this child.
Yeah. The world, like, will do it anyway. So
the world will do it. Yeah. Like, yeah. So like,
so it's one of those, like, I don't want to make it, I'm not going to give her my problems because.
Right. Yeah. Can I not screw this up? You know?
Yes. Yes. And that is a big burden.
That's a burden. That's
a psychological burden.
That is a heavy psychological burden, is to keep her safe from me. And so that's a big part of the motivation now for the medication, for the therapy, for, you know, for all the pieces that are coming together, is to, you know, recognize that, like, that rage that comes out, like, left unchecked, like, that's not good for them. That's not doing them any favors.
Right. Well, I do think, and one of the things I always tell my husband and that I think about when it comes to my child, is that our level of awareness is much higher than our parents was. You know, like, we are more aware of how it's affecting us.
Yeah.
And I feel like the awareness, the addition of medications and therapy, yeah, and just the total, like, I'm going to say, all around self-awareness of what's going on each day and how, yeah, I'm acting. Like, I feel like my child has a pretty decent shot of, I'm going to say 25% better than what I had.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I mean, I feel like my kids have a lot more resource. Like, my kids are going to like private schools and stuff. Like, my kids, yes, that, you know, that are way more like accommodating, you know, yeah, to an individual.
There's so many more accommodations these days.
Yeah. Like,
I can't believe when you were saying about going to that private school, I was thinking to myself, I was like, oh, I was a girl with ADHD and I went to public school, mm-hmm, and there was no accommodation. It was like, yeah, I just had to go down to the nurse and get my medication and feel like I felt really like embarrassed about it.
Yeah.
I just had to go down to the school nurse and get my medication in the middle of the day because they didn't have all that extended release stuff yet.
Right. Yeah. The private school was a good experience, but at the same time, like, everybody who went to that school was very aware that I am riding the short bus.
Like, that's the thing. Yeah.
Like every other kid in your neighborhood goes to that bus stop, and I go to this bus stop over here for the, yeah, short bus.
Yeah. I don't know. I went to, like I said, I actually was in I don't want to say a gifted program, but, mm-hmm, I was in a program because my school allowed me to take advanced courses in the things I was really good at.
That's good.
So I think because I was surrounded by some high achieving people,
mm-hmm,
the ones at the top of my class, I think it sort of forced me to rise to the occasion in a lot of ways.
Yeah. So I mean,
that's
like,
how I got through my education.
Right.
Pressure, like, from the outside, but
Yeah. I mean, I think engagement is important, and you know, the people in the class with you are a big part of that engagement. And so, yeah, who's teaching, who's in the class with you, all of this stuff makes a huge difference in how not bored you are.
Oh yeah. In terms of your educational experience. Yes.
Yeah. So, and you know, when you're low on dopamine and you're just, you know, jonesing for dopamine, then, you know, whatever gets you there is great. And so if that happens to be what gets you a good grade in that class, awesome. And if it's not,
yep.
What if, you know, like
while you're on the topic of jonesing, like thrill seeking,
yeah.
Tell me about thrill seeking. Tell me about the role that plays in what you do.
Yeah, it's a big part of what I do in a lot of ways. You know, for a lot of people, just stepping out on stage is both terrifying and exhilarating. And that doesn't go away so much as it changes with time. You know, there's certainly with my regular gigs, you know, venues that I play all the time, there's a lot of like resorts. Family resorts are pretty steady part of my income, and so yeah, entertaining families on vacation is a big part of what I do. But so these are you know, a handful of venues that have, you know, a little stage in some places, or you know, a big theater in others, and that I've played, you know, for years and years and years now. And going to those, you know, is very comfortable and very relaxing. But every once in a while, something new comes in. Like there's, you know, a corporate gig just falls in my lap or something, you know, or, you know, like a big theater again, kind of falls in my lap. You know, agent comes through with something really good. And I'm backstage, you know, with, I don't know, maybe like 800 people out, you know, on the other side of that curtain. And that, you know, that nervous energy that like early in my life was really crippling. Like it was too much. It was too intense. Like I felt like I couldn't step out on it. You know, there was really crippling levels of stage fright, you know, sort of.
That's how I am.
Middle school and through the beginning of high school for me.
I still don't, I don't even do public speaking.
It's, I mean, there, it's that fear is intense. That fear it's, like I experience just a little bit of that fear sometimes standing behind the curtain. And when I do now, it's, I welcome that like an old friend. Like that's, it's like, oh, hello. I haven't seen you in a long time. And it's nice. It reminds me that like, I don't work in a cubicle. Like yeah. This is the reason I'm here.
Do you think that your performance is better when you get that rush?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Okay. So like going to a kid's birthday party with 20 kids is probably not going to do it for you.
Probably not. Yeah. Right. There's not much at risk. No, you're playing it safe there.
Yeah, definitely.
And so there's that aspect of the danger, the risk in what I do. And there is physical risk in what I do. I'm a sword swallower. I'm a fire eater. I lay on a bed of nails. You know, the physical risks are not as dangerous as they appear to the audience, I'd like to think. But they are there.
Is there an element of, I'm going to say, continuing education?
There is. Yeah. Okay. There are constantly things that I would like to learn.
ADHD, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, there's never, there are always more physical skills that if I have time and opportunity, I would love to get into the gym and rehearse. Right now, I'd love to learn how to spit ping pong balls out of my mouth and juggle three ping pong balls with my mouth. That's a killer act that plays, you know, packs small and plays big.
I think we should do a study and find out of the, I'm going to say the entertainers, the magicians.
Particularly with jugglers, the percentage, just, you know, my experience, the percentage of them that have ADHD is way higher than the normal population. It both rewards hyper-focus.
Yeah.
You know, it's a physical activity for the sort of person who has like a physical hyperactivity to you.
Yeah. The impulsive presentation. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Impulsive.
Then, you know, like it's great to teach juggling to a kid, you know, who like there's a certain age where like kids will be like, I'm going to see if I can do that 1,000 times in a row.
Yes.
And that is exactly the type of practice that is most beneficial to being a juggler. So if you are the sort of person who thinks like, man, I would really love to lock myself in a room and try that 1,000 times, you should be a juggler.
Oh, that's so funny. My son would love that. Because my son, Dustin.
He's how old? Eight?
Eight. Very repetitiously.
He's a little young. Like usually, like an exceptional eight-year-old, I can teach like to juggle three balls. I might teach 7, 8 years old, I would try scarves. Scarves float slowly, so you can toss a scarf up and it'll float down slowly.
We have fine motor skills issues too, so I don't know. But
it may be, well, that's the thing, is that it may be therapeutic in a way.
Oh.
So it may be part of a physical therapy kind of, you know. It's nice because it's the sort of thing, you know, for me, I never played sports. And I think part of it is a bit of perfectionism, a bit of like, these kids already know how to do this and I don't know how to do this.
Yep.
But I think there was also that team activities did not jive well with me, and that competition did not jive well with me.
I had to drop out of track and stuff because I couldn't deal with
track. I think track I would have handled better because it's less collaborative. Mm-hmm. You know, I always wanted to sort of succeed or fail on my own.
I couldn't do the competition. I liked practices.
Mm-hmm.
Sports practice. I did field hockey 1 year mm-hmm. too. I liked the practice, but when it came down to the competition, it was too much for me.
Yeah.
Like I couldn't.
And yeah. The any activity where there has to be a loser in order for us to engage in the activity really turned me off.
Yeah. I think I was the same.
So,
I think my son is the same way too.
Yeah. And so juggling was nice because it was a physical activity that was not competitive, or at least not inherently. You know, you could compete against somebody else. Like, let's see how many catches you can get. Let's see how many catches I can get. Or you can just compete against yourself in a sense of like, let's see how far I can get today. That, you know, can I push past where I was yesterday? So you can set milestones. You can measure your progress easily. Ultimately you can measure, you know, it's either in the air or it's on the ground. You know, there is, you know, success is easily defined.
And that makes sense because sometimes with us, we see things in very black and white ways.
Right.
It's very hard to see like forward motion. It's either like we're perfect or we don't have a clue.
Yeah.
And we don't know what the midway point is and we don't have, yes. Okay.
So in some ways you can, the nice thing was in that you can challenge yourself if you want, but you can also, it's very easy to quit and try something else different. You know, like when I practice, like I bring at least 5 or 6 different things with me, you know,
I was gonna ask you that. How do you prepare for a show? Like, how do you decide what you're going to do?
So a lot of people ask me like, you know, well, how many hours a day do you practice? And I laugh and think like, oh God, it's been, you know, it's only recently that I have both kids in school now, you know, so both, you know, the little ones in a daycare that's, you know, just down the road from the big one's school. And so I've got some time during the day and, you know, a therapist just really kept pounding into me, like, you've got to do something, you've got to work out, you know, you've got to have some physical activity every day.
It'll help you regulate a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. And so with that sort of giving me permission in a sense, you know, I joined a gym and I'm pretty good about getting into the gym for about an hour, you know, on days when I'm not working and the kids are in school. So this often works out to like maybe 3 days a week. And I'll try to do some cardio. I'll try to get on, you know, 20 minutes on an elliptical, 20 minutes of stretching. This is just kind of trying to maintain my body as, you know, I'm not getting any younger and this stuff's getting harder. And, you know, and then maybe I'll juggle for 20 minutes, you know, probably do 2 or 3 different things at least in that time. And this is all stuff that I'm working on or maybe just refreshing, you know, the harder skills of things that I already do. It's just checking in. It's just, you know, seeing where I am.
So does it work work better for you if you have a deadline? Like if your agent says, I just booked you last minute for a show this Saturday, like how would you handle that?
I'm ready to do a show like an hour from now. Like there's no,
okay.
Doing an hour long show is what I, you know, that is not, you know, that's not something that needs preparation.
Oh, that's awesome. So you can go and you take a bunch of your stuff with you and you decide on the spot how you're.
I mean, the minivan is packed with, you know, a little over an hour's worth of material.
Okay.
Two car seats. So, you know, the sound system is loaded, the lighting, it takes longer to load in than it does to do.
Yeah.
You know, it's like an hour and a half to load in the whole show. It's, you know, an hour to do the show. It's an hour and a half to pack the show back into the car. It's, you know, it's, there are things like I've never done a cruise ship and it's a tough gig to break into. And so I'm like on a couple people's C list, you know? And so they only get to that very often when somebody is sick, somebody is injured, somebody's mom dies. And last minute I get a frantic call that said, you know, at 10 in the morning that says, hey, can you be on a cruise ship in Brooklyn here, you know, in New York at 4 PM today? Where am I going? Scotland. You'll be gone for 8 days. I'd love to. I can't. Okay. Bye.
Yeah. You know what? You make a good point because I feel like with us, for a lot of us, especially mm-hmm. If you're self-employed,
right.
I feel that there's like this fine line between too much open space and then we get mm-hmm. nothing done.
Yeah.
But yet we need a little support and structure for some of this more tedious.
Yeah. And having somebody who calls you every week and says, what should I accomplish in my time this week?
That's, yeah.
Checks in with you and you think, yeah, what should get accomplished this week? Because yeah, otherwise it's really easy to be like, there's nothing pressing. There are no fires that need to be put out. I'm going to chill.
Yes. And it forces you to like make those decisions and prioritize.
Right. Right, exactly. And because things,
time.
So often the success of your business hinges on what you do when you have a little bit of time.
Yes.
That's the time to prepare, you know, for when there's a crunch time coming later.
Yes.
You know,
to this question.
Yes.
You said, as my business grows, where is it going? What do you want to do?
It's a real good question. I have a lot of decisions to make right now. You know, while there's a certain amount of growth that happens organically, and there are certain marketing practices that I've gotten a bit better at, and some of that, a lot of that actually deals with automation and trying to plan ahead of time, you know, okay, this is this type of gig. If it's a school or a library or something local, you know, there's sort of a routine in place, you know, that is automated, like, oh, local school or library gig. So this is a school. I've got this, you know, software, this sort of system that I'm using now that is designed for performers, but really nice meshes it, you know, great for ADHD performers, in that you can sort of do a lot of the work up front and make a lot of the decisions about like, okay, you know, I'm doing this at a show at this time for this much money. Great. I'll send you a contract. And I go to my system and I say, this is a library. Does the standards, you know, library routine of contact emails make sense for this? Yes, it does. It's essentially, you know, is the information put in correctly? Yes, it is, because they've put it in on my website themselves by filling out a form. Great. It's a one-touch operation, you know, do the library automation, and it sends them an email immediately that says, thank you so much, you know, for your business. Here's the contract for your date and time. You can fill this, you can pay this with PayPal, or it can send me a check, you know, and a day or two later, it sends an email that says, if you need it, here's the W-9 form. And if you need it, here's a photo of me for promotional material. 3 days before the show starts, it sends them another email that says, just checking in. We've got a show on this date and time. If anything's changed, let me know. If there's any concerns about parking, be sure to, you know, give me a heads up about that. And I'll see you in a few days.
All right.
3 days after the show happens, they get an email that says, thank you so much for having me. It was a wonderful show. I'm, you know, If you'd like to follow me on social media, you can do so here. And if you'd like to write a review of the show, you can do so here.
That's awesome that you've automated it so much.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's really, that's
so the VA, if there's any, you know, data entry that needs to be done, like if this was booked by an email, you know, like if they contacted me and said, here's all the information, can we get a quote? I send them back a quote. And if they say yes, that whole thing gets forwarded to my assistant. And I says, put this in the system, you know, and, you know, use this automation. There are certain goals that I have that are goals, that things that I would love to do that are hard to do. If I were to get onto ships, if I were to do like a Disney cruise or something, which would be in many ways a dream for me. You know, the shows that I do at these family resorts, you know, I feel, you know, that's the next logical evolution, for me. That would be tough. It's hard to be, you know, a lot of that means being away for, you know, a week at a time. My kids are still little, you know, my little one is two. And it is hard for me to be away for a week at a time. It's really tough on my wife, for me to be away, even with as much help as we get from family and great babysitters, during those times. You know, during the summer, we usually get a nanny, mm-hmm. working, you know, minimum 40 hours a week. Cause I'm gone, you know, for weeks at a time in the summer. And even if it's not like I'm out of town, like I've got so many weeks where I'm leaving before dawn, driving for 2 hours, doing three shows, you know, packing it all up, driving home, you know, and I, you know, I'll get in at 9 after the kids get to bed, you know, say hi to my wife and sleep for a few hours and go do the whole thing the next day. That's the crunch time. And yeah. That is where, you know, that's where like about 70% of the income comes from is the summer and that crunch time of just day after day where you can work every day if you want to. And at this point, I'm trying to decide if I want to. The cruise ships would be, you know, more flights, but less grind. Be two shows a week, you know, and then you're a guest on a cruise ship. Like it's...
Yeah. And at least it would be a set schedule, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So a lot of the things I'd love to do more theaters. One of those comes my way every once in a while. You know, my show has always been just entertainment.
Yeah.
You know, I've never had, or at times, you know, I've done shows like for like adults. I've done stuff for the Fringe Festival that was, you know, sort of a self-expression. Yeah. Trying to figure out what it is that I want to say to kids has always been a kind of daunting to me.
Well, practice saying it to adults on here and then we can adjust it for kids.
Yeah. I mean, to a certain extent, you know, like I talked about the idea of like the sword swallowing actor, you know, there are, you know, in my, you know, sort of in the back of my head every once in a while, ideas about how to talk about ADHD, or, you know, my experience of it. And trying to figure out, oh yeah, what from my experience, you know, what is the sort of universal, you know, truth to be acknowledged from this experience?
I think our children, I mean, my son is considered to be high functioning autistic, although he's mm-hmm. much more high functioning than me, I think sometimes. Right. But he did say to me one day, what is autism, Mom?
Yeah.
You know, like he asked me and I thought about it and I was like, well, you know, your brain is different.
Yeah.
Your brain is special and it's different. Mm-hmm. And Mom's brain is different too.
Yeah.
She has ADHD, you know, and I think kids are curious.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know. I think that's something you should totally like turn around in your head.
Yeah. So I've been working on that kind of off and on, and I've started talking with some of my kids' teachers about some of these topics from their point of view. You know, and the benefit of that is not that it's like big money, you know, or glamorous in the way a lot of the things I would like to do are, but there is a lot of demand for it. There's a lot of work out there, and it's work that I could do while my kids are in school.
Yes.
You know, if I could, you know, add a few shows during the week and do less shows during the weekend, that would make a life a lot easier for my wife. That would, you know, that's an attractive option at this point in my life.
So what do you think the adults, because this, I'm going to say the market for this, podcast is more adult.
Yeah.
What would you like want people to know about your life, your career?
Yeah.
ADHD?
Right. So some of the things that, some of the messages, are that, you know, my brain is different and that's affected the choices that I've made in my life. And that, you know, I wound up here through a process of elimination in a sense. You know, like people come up to me all the time after my shows and say, oh, you're so lucky that you get to live your dream. And I'm like, you do know this is dream number four, right? Like there are a lot of dreams that had to die before we got here. All right. Like I had to accept that, like, okay, Dave, the fact that you really love these science classes doesn't really matter if you can't handle the math. If you're failing your math class, they won't give you the hard science class.
It's true.
For entirely good reasons. Mm-hmm. You need math.
Yep.
And like, I know, like, no matter how much you love the concepts or the idea of being a scientist, this is not the path for you. And scientist, by the way, would have been a terrible job for me. Like, I realize that now. Like, I respect them so much, but like, their lives would have been boring as hell for me. Because, like, to me, like, science was this story of one genius after another having a breakthrough that changed the world. And I wanted to be one of those geniuses who changed the world. But that is a momentary breakthrough. And momentary breakthroughs come at the end of long, tedious careers of experiments that are boring as hell.
That's true. But I guess you're a different kind of scientist.
Maybe. I mean, for me, you know, the experiment is like, does this joke land tonight? does joke A land with audience B in venue C? Yeah. That is the data that I am collecting.
Yeah, I don't know. I do feel like you are doing your thing. And it is a process of elimination. You're
it
right.
is, right. And so, I mean, looking for what it is that, you know, that excites you is your primary job as a kid. Like figuring out what it is that you know, that you're going to pour yourself into, is that's the goal. And like, once you figure that out, a lot of other stuff becomes clearer.
And I think that is true in life when you have ADHD. You know, you got to figure out the balance between keeping yourself stimulated, because we're always seeking. We seem to be seekers. Like, we seem to always be looking for some new information, some way to feed the dopamine, right?
Right.
And I think as an adult, there is like this balance between, you know, making a living,
right,
perceived as a responsible tax-paying citizen,
right,
and getting what you need to keep yourself engaged in life,
like, right. I mean, in a sense this is almost easier for us because we don't have a choice.
Yeah, we don't really.
Like, you know,
people think we do.
Right. You know, like, it's really clear to us what is and is not a passion.
Oh yes.
And it's not a conscious decision. Sometimes kids ask me questions after my shows, and sometimes they're really heartbreakingly difficult to answer. You know, like, every once in a while a kid says, why did you choose this career? And the most honest answer I've decided I can give them is, I don't know. It's something you feel.
Mm-hmm.
It's like asking me, why did you marry your wife? Like, there are a lot of justifications I can give you. There are a lot of perfectly good reasons why I married my wife. But the real answer is not something I can put into words exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It's something you feel.
Yep.
And so, you know, that's what my career is to me. You know, that's what that decision was for me. You know, the career advice the only sensible career advice I can give built around that is to, you know, as a kid, you know, try as many things as you possibly can, you know, to realize that the thing that motivates you is, you know, it could be anywhere. It's, you know, it can, and to not judge it, to not, you know, think about like what other people are going to think about it or think about you, or, you know, to sort of trust your reaction to it, to trust that passion. You know, like I joke with people that, you know, I didn't choose the jug life. The jug life chose me. But that is kind of how it feels sometimes, that like, I don't know what combination of things in my head got so, you know, why this clicks into place for me. But it does for me in a way that it doesn't for other heads. And I had to respect that, you know, and that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to make a profession out of that. And there are some people who, you know, there are other things that people with my, you know, particular type of issues do happily for money, and then also do this happily as a hobby, and in many ways enjoy it more than I do, for it being their hobby.
It is interesting when something you love turns into your livelihood, it changes the dynamic.
Everything. Yeah.
Yeah. That's for sure.
Yeah.
So where can people find you, learn more about you, contact you if they would like to?
So onemansideshow.com is the old website, and the new website is daviddarwin.com. And I think eventually these are going to split into two different markets. Okay. But I think eventually daviddarwin.com is going to be like corporate work and adult, you know, kind of focused shows, and One Man Sideshow I think will become my kids' market, though right now those distinctions have not been drawn as clearly as I would like them to be. But
all right, no big deal.
And they can follow me on social media at One Man Sideshow on all social media platforms.
Do you have like I think I saw a small YouTube channel. Do you have that?
I do have One Man Sideshow is me on YouTube.
Well, thanks so much for answering all my questions today.
No problem.
Anything else you want to add at the end before I turn it off?
No, I mean, I think that's the, you know, the message I think for me is that finding a career that suits your brain, your needs. And, you know, in terms of like the risk taking, many of the things that I do have an element of physical danger to them, but in ways that I think are sustainable. Like, yes, if something goes horribly wrong, it could be bad for me. You know, there are a lot of ways that people can seek danger that are not sustainable. You know, there are people who mean a lot to me who struggle with addiction. There are people who mean a lot to me who struggle with gambling, who are seeking their thrills in ways that are just not benefiting them in any way, you know? And so I used to ride a motorcycle, and what I loved about it was that it made, you know, going out and buying some milk from the grocery store an adventure, yeah. You know, and there, you know, finding ways where like, yes, there's a possibility of this going horribly wrong, but man, if everything lines up, like this is going to be a lot of fun and I'm going to get the thrill that I need.
That's actually an excellent point. Yeah. I mean, thrill seeking in a sustainable way is very right. different than self-medicating and doing very dangerous things.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So seek your thrills, mm-hmm. but do it in a way that like, if this goes perfectly, if this goes according to plan, I am going to benefit from this.
Right. I feel that.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed this podcast as much as I did. You know, talking to David, it really sort of hit home for me that some of us, we can be, you know, thrill seeking, novelty seeking with ADHD, but it doesn't always have to be a bad thing. And, you know, acknowledging and treating your ADHD goes a long way to making this life, you know, more rich and valuable. Do a girl a favor, go over to see in ADHD on iTunes and leave me a review. It does not have to be anything fancy. Just a line or two is fine. And stay tuned. Next week, I have another guest. I'm really pretty excited about him, too. This is a young man who is starting the conversation.
About things like mental health and toxic masculinity, because little boys become grown men.
He sits down with me and we have a really great conversation. Stick around. Like I always say, we are stronger together.